Been talking about Joshua and possessing the promised land, and we've brought the people out of slavery in Egypt. They've wandered around. Well, they came to the borders of the land, went in, took a look. 12 spies went in. 10 came back, said, nope, we can't do it. 2 came back, said, if God's with us, we can do anything. Well, they believed the majority report and wandered around for 40 years in the wilderness, and during which time an entire generation dies off. They come right back to the same place, the same border of the promised land, and Moses goes into great detail to recount to them the history of their nation from Abraham to the present, including how God delivered them miraculously out of Egypt, how God had preserved them for 40 years, what the requirements of his Torah, his teaching was, and gave the people the opportunity to say, yes, we'll do it, which they did. And Moses said, but you can't do it, it's too hard. They said, oh, yes, we will. He said, okay. Moses then went home, went up on the mountain. God took him home. Joshua takes over. We talked at length about how Joshua was commissioned to that, what God's promises and what have you were. We talked about in the last session, we talked about the people actually coming across the river into the land of promise, like a birthing experience. They came through the waters into the land of the promise. And now we find them. They have crossed the Jordan River. They are technically in the land, but they haven't possessed any of the land. Now, the promise was wherever you set your foot on, you'll possess. But at this point in time, okay, we've done the journey. God dammed up the river. We came across on dry ground. We built a memorial on this side. Now here we are. What's next? Okay. So they have come to this place, and we're going to start in chapter 5. Now, it's really interesting here. In a time without mass media, in a time without the news service and satellite TV and the internet, no Facebook, but apparently word traveled fast. Now, when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed over, their hearts melted in fear, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. And now we heard years ago that these Israelites came up out of Egypt and they defeated some other kings on the other side of the river. We've heard that, but we haven't heard anything out of these folks for a generation now, so I guess they're not that big a threat. Oh, wait a minute. You're telling me the Jordan River was in flood, and their God dried up the river, and they crossed the river on dry ground into our land? We've got a problem. If they've got a God with them who is that strong, how can we possibly stand against them? Isn't it interesting how the pagans recognized the hand of God and believed in it probably more than the chosen people of God did? You know, that's a tough one to swallow. But, you know, you've heard that old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. And I think this is a problem often with the modern church, is that it's so easy for us to get to God. How many people have a Bible in their house? How many people have 5 Bibles in their house? 10? I have a virtually unlimited supply right here, okay, on a phone. Now, it's awful easy to get to the Word of God. A few weeks ago, we had a Gideon speaker in here. And the Gideons have been working diligently for decades to get Bibles in the hands of people. They go to foreign countries where they virtually take their lives in their own hand to distribute the Word of God. Okay? Everybody doesn't have the advantages we do. We can get 24-hour-a-day preaching and teaching on the internet, on the television, on the radio. We can listen to gospel music anytime, day or night. We can go to any number of churches. It's up to us how we consume the gospel product that's available to us. And sometimes I think it's so easy for us to do that we take it completely for granted. And people who have never heard it hunger for it. And those of us who ought to be sustained by it, I'll get around to that tomorrow. Thus, the modern church is weak because we're not reinforcing ourselves with the Word. But that was kind of a digression from the story here. But notice that these pagan kings, now, God has promised the Israelites that He's going to give them every place they put their foot. And He established the boundaries of what that piece of property was going to be. And it's huge. And now, on day one, He's put the fear of God, literally, into the hearts of those people that occupy that land. So, if we were military strategists, we would take advantage of our advantage and strike quickly and try to take advantage of them while they're scared, right? Wouldn't that be the human thing to do? Well, there's a little business that needs to be taken care of first. In chapter 5, verse 2, at that time the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites again. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites at Gibeah Haraloth. This is why he did so. All those who came out of Egypt, all the men of military age, died in the wilderness on the way after leaving Egypt. All the people that came out and had been circumcised, but the people born in the wilderness during the journey from Egypt had not. The Israelites had moved about in the wilderness 40 years until all the men who were of military age when they left Egypt had died, since they had not obeyed the Lord, for the Lord had sworn to them that they would not see the land He had solemnly promised to their ancestors to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So He raised up their sons in their place, and these were the ones Joshua circumcised. They were still uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way, and after the whole nation had been circumcised, they remained where they were in camp until they were healed. What is the deal with circumcision? Why was it important? It was the mark or the sign of the covenant. What covenant? I will be your God, and you will be my people. And he gave Moses instruction, not Moses, he gave Abraham instructions on how this was to take place. Abraham was an adult when it happened. Ishmael was 13. Yitzhak, Isaac, the son of the promise, was 8 days old. And the commandment was, the mitzvah was, that the eighth day, the male child will be circumcised as the sign of the covenant. You know how critical it was that that be done?
How come they didn't continue to do that?
Well, that's a good question. And that's a question the Bible does not answer. But let me do a little more foundation work, and I'm going to touch on it because I've got an idea or two of why that might not have happened. But it was such a big deal, you could do it on Sabbath. When a child was 8 days old, the circumcision was to be done even if that day was the Sabbath. Even if that day was Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most high holy day of the year. And when you may do no work, a circumcision was to be held if it was the eighth day. Okay. So it was important to them to be done. Anybody have any idea why an eighth day?
Beginning.
Eighth day is a new beginning. 7 days is a complete cycle, right?
Yeah.
The eighth day is a new beginning. So that entering into the covenant family is done on a new beginning. But it's a strange thing. You would think if there was a mark to show that you were one of the covenant people of God, it would be something that could
just look out and see.
Be seen. You know, pierce your ear. You know? Put a bone through your nose. Yeah, do something that when you're walking down the street, say, "Hey, that guy's an Israelite." Okay. But strangely enough, God chooses a mark of the covenant that is seen after it's initially done only by your mother or your nurse, or by yourself, or by your spouse. Strange. So the mark of the covenant is something internal. It refers to something that's private between you and God. Yeah, I'm one of the covenant people, but I'm the only one that can see the mark. But isn't that how what the New Testament calls circumcision of the heart works? Isn't it an internal thing? And you see not the mark of the covenant itself, but you see the behavior and the lifestyle and the outgrowth of the mark of the covenant. These folks came through the desert. They accepted the teaching of the Torah that Moses gave them before he died. They said, "Yes, we'll do it." They consecrated themselves for 3 days and they came across the river. They came through the waters. Coming through the waters, isn't that it's a birthing metaphor, but it's also a baptismal metaphor. And now they get the mark of the covenant. I'm going to throw a few things out about that particular mark of the covenant because it is... there's some hidden meaning there.
Is there any theory why they didn't have to do it before they crossed the river?
If we look at it as a metaphor, as a Christian metaphor, right? Entering into the covenant people happens after the new birth. So this is why I think it was. And also, there's another very practical reason. Why had their fathers died in the wilderness? Unbelief. They disobeyed God, said, "We can't take the promised land. We ain't crossing that river." Which might be part of your earlier question as to why those people in the wilderness were not circumcised. Because the people, the adults that would have been doing the circumcision had stepped out of covenant with God. They disobeyed God. They weren't qualified. Why would I want to enter into a covenant with a disobedient people? Right? Now they've crossed the river, they're an obedient people. The practical reason is they've been wandering around in the desert for 40 years. You know? I assume everybody here knows what's involved in circumcision. The excess skin is cut away. And what that does is two things. From a purely medical standpoint, which is why many in the Western world practice it not as a mark of the covenant, but as a hygienic item, there is excess flesh cut away that is a vessel or a location that would harbor corruption. difficult to claim, infection, whatever. Okay? So from a practical sense, flesh is cut away. And flesh has the potential to harbor corruption. Do you see the spiritual parallel here? Right? We're to put the flesh to death, right? Because it harbors corruption. The flesh wants things that are ungodly. And it provides a good environment for those things to breed and grow. So, you know, this particular mark of the covenant is symbolic in that that excess flesh is cut away and the ability or the location to easily harbor corruption is gone. The other thing that it does is it exposes a more sensitive skin. The reason that that particular flap of flesh exists is protection. Okay? So the sensitivity is exposed. Now, with us spiritually, when the flesh is cut away, then the spirit, the heart, the inner man is more exposed to be sensitive to spiritual things. Okay? So there's symbolism in all of this. The other thing is that the covenant is supposed to reproduce itself, right? So this particular mark of the covenant occurs in an area involved with reproduction, right? The Bible speaks of things in agricultural terms. You know, in agricultural terms, the seed is planted in the soil and the crop grows. Well, in biological terms, the Bible uses the same kind of a terminology or a theology. The man carries the seed. Seed's planted, growth occurs. Okay? So the location of the mark of the covenant occurs at the point of regeneration. Okay? So the covenant people are supposed to reproduce. That's how we get to be lots of covenant people, right? Not necessarily in the physical sense as it was in the Old Testament, but certainly in a spiritual sense, we are supposed to spread the seed and reproduce covenant believers. Okay? So much for your daily biological lesson. But why now? Why now? They've just, you know, all these experiences in the wilderness, they've crossed. You know, as Connie said, why didn't they do it before they crossed the river? You know, militarily it would have made a whole lot more sense because, you know, the whole camp is pretty much defenseless for a few days after this occurs. I think, again, it has to do with that idea of the sequence of the obedience, the rebirth, the passing through, and now is time for the mark. Okay, all right, you've done it. You can be covenant people. Okay. I'm going to divert back to the biological lesson for just a minute. Today, if you have a male child and you decide to have that child circumcised, it's done at a day old in one of those freezing cold operating rooms on a stainless steel table under glaring lights by a bunch of people wearing masks. Not very inviting, is it? You know how it's done in Jewish tradition?
Same way at all.
Here's what happens. At 8 days old, the mother is still ritually unclean, so she's in the next room. The child is given to a godfather, a friend of the family, a relation, someone who is a spiritual mentor. It happens in the home. It happens in the presence of family and friends who love the child and love the family, who are also members of the covenant community. And the child is held by someone who loves them while the moel performs the operation. And they say that a lot of times the child doesn't even cry. See the difference in atmosphere? The difference in symbolism? As far as the Jews go, you're welcoming a child into the covenant community. And there's a big difference between harsh lights and cold tables. And this. You know, hi. You're very content. Babies either love me or scream at me, one or the other. See, I got glasses and I got a beard. Come on, go back to grandma. Here we go.
Practicing.
Thank you. Thank you for being in the same.
I'm
going to
see
you
do that.
But, you know, you see.
Hasn't it also been proven that the eighth day is the highest immunity of the child?
That is typically reported. You know, a child, when they're first born, has immunity from its mother while its own immune system begins to develop. And there are some research that says the eighth day is about the peak. So the designer, you know, the guy that wrote the owner's manual, the guy that did all the specifications for human beings,
he knows.
I think he probably designed it that way. Oh, goodness. So give me that bottle over there. All right. Why is belonging important? Why do these people need to enter into a covenant community? Why do we enter into covenant to be members of a church together? I guess we need to go back to 101. Everybody's looking at it. It's important because we have shared priorities. We have shared goals. As Ray just said, we have commitment. I am one of you. Three Musketeers, right? One for all for one. Well, you know, to be part of the covenant community, it's now no longer all about me. It's about us. The modern church, particularly in America, has put so much emphasis on your personal relationship with Jesus. Now, that's true. I have to have one-on-one with him. But God has historically dealt with his people in community. Community is important. My relationship one-on-one with God is primary. But he has designed us to be in community together. We can accomplish so much more together than we can as individuals. When I get tired, when I get weak, when I get frustrated, there's one of you out there to pick me up. Maybe several of you, I hope. By the same token, when it happens to you, we ought to be running to you to pick you up. When the enemy comes against us, he's not just coming against me, he's coming against us. And we all rise up to the mutual defense of the body. See, these guys were going to do it in a practical fashion. They were going to war. You expect all those folks just to move out, let them have their land and their cities and their cattle and their crops? They're getting ready to go to war. They needed to be bound together. Newsflash. You're in a war, Christian. There's an enemy that wants to destroy you. There is a world out there that operates under the enemy system that neither respects us nor gives us any credit. It seeks to destroy us. It seeks to discourage us. It seeks to cause us to just want to throw up our hands in despair and say, "What's the use? I'm just going back to bed." think I'll watch TV today. Or just cover my head up with a blanket. That's what the world wants us to do.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. But you know what? A commitment, particularly a commitment made in public, will hold you to something when everything in you says, no, I don't want to. Why is a marriage a public event? You're swearing before God and people that I'm with her and she's with me. And we are one flesh. And I'm calling on the whole world to witness it. Those of you that wear a ring, I can't with my knuckles right now. But that's a symbol that says, hey, this one's taken. It's a reminder to you and to everybody else. Right? So it's a public commitment. So when that moment of weakness or temptation comes, I can't do that. I stood in front of God and I stood in front of people and I said, I wouldn't do that. I'm with her and she's with me. Temptation, get away from me. No. See, a vow made in public will hold you together a lot of times when the tempter comes in private. This public commitment, this public unity was going to be critically important for Israel. It is more important for us today. We may not be taking up arms and trying to dispossess the enemy from physical towns, but we have a spiritual battle that is constant. The enemy attacks us individually. He attacks our families. He attacks this church. He attacks this community. Listen to the news and listen to drug addiction. And today, well, not today literally, but in recent, how many high-profile, wealthy, powerful people have gotten so far into despair that they took their own lives? People who had apparently everything to live for, materially anyway. You see, that's the battle we're in. The devil frankly doesn't care if you're prosperous or poor, if you're happy or sad, as long as he can distract you from doing what God wants you to do. We are in a battle. We need each other sometimes. Walk up and say, soldier, straighten up, stand up, get yourself together, we got work to do. And we respond, yes, sir.
Sometimes I think we don't realize that the battle is all around us. We don't realize that we should be fighting. We don't realize that when somebody says something to us and we want to get offended, that's a battle. We don't realize that when our belief system has been based on legalism, that's a battle to break away from that legalism. That's a fight to divorce yourself from that line of thinking that you've been taught and fed your whole life. You know, it's about, all these things are battles. These are spiritual warfare battles, but we don't see them as being spiritual warfare battles. You know, and I think we need to wake up to that, because it's how we deal with these will be how we fought the other enemies away from our family and away from our church and our health and all these other things.
We take things so for granted in that realm too. That's just how the world is. Everybody has bad luck. Things go crazy. People run out of money. People get sick. That's just the world we live in.
It ain't going to justify the world that we're under.
It will even use Bible verses to justify it. But we are in a battle. We don't recognize that we're in a battle. You know, in World War II, there were more casualties killed and wounded in the Soviet Union than there were in the rest of the war all put together. Japanese, Americans, Brits, French, Italians, doesn't come close to the amount of people from the Soviet Union that were killed. And how do you suppose that was divided up between military and civilian? Way more civilians died than military did. They weren't actively fighting the battle. They didn't have uniforms and helmets and rifles.
They was in the way.
But they were in the war. And we are in the war, whether we're cognizant of it or not. You know, a child that size living in Stalingrad during the siege statistically is going to die. Okay? That child has no concept it's in a battle. Its mother probably did. But you see, we're in it whether we realize it or not. So how much better if we take up arms and get some orders and participate than to let the battle overrun us. And I think the church has been sold this bill of goods that we just sit by and God will put a hedge of protection around us and the war will just go right on around us. Not only is it patently untrue, the Bible teaches us completely differently. Did Jesus not tell Peter, tell somebody who doesn't have a sword to go buy one? We're in a battle. These people were getting ready to be in a battle. So they circumcise the men. They get in back into the covenant situation. But they weren't done. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you, so the place has been called Gilgal to this day." Gilgal sounds like the Hebrew word for to roll. What was the reproach of Egypt? What is reproach? It's bad reputation, right? It's something, it's a mark against you. So what would the reproach, huh? They were slaves. And the generation that came out of Egypt couldn't get their slave mentality out of them to possess the problem. They possessed the problem. They didn't possess the promise. Okay? It was a problem that they didn't possess the promise. Okay? So what happens here is, to me, the reproach was their inability to believe God that led to their destruction. That's why, clean slate, new start, let's circumcise this new generation. Let's start fresh from the covenant. It's almost like a new birth for the nation. You know, if you look at it, if the Exodus from Egypt is the birth of Israel as a nation, this is almost a born-again scenario as they come into the promised land. It's like a second birth. Prefigures New Testament again, doesn't it? So they've circumcised, and now there's something else that needs to happen. On the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. The day after the Passover, that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites, but that year they ate the produce of Canaan. Why the Passover? What's the Passover about? Deliverance. So 40 years ago, they were delivered from their taskmasters in Egypt on this very night. Okay, so, and they were instructed to keep the Passover. I wonder if they kept the Passover wandering in the wilderness. Kind of doubt it.
I doubt it.
Kind of doubt it. But here they keep it there. And it celebrates God's deliverance with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Delivered you from the hands of your captors, right? So here we have a celebration of God's deliverance. So it all, this whole new start motif continues all the way through this. So the day after, they ate the fruit of the land and what happened?
No more manna.
The gravy train stopped.
Yep, get you on now.
What is the difference? See, the manna was always meant to be sustenance. During the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, they saw the column of cloud by day and the column of cloud by night. 6 days a week, they gathered miraculous food from the ground. God cared for them. He led them to places where they could get water. Their shoes didn't wear out in 40 years. Sorry, ladies, you can't get a new pair in the wilderness anyway. No shoe stores out there. The clothes didn't wear out. The shoes didn't wear out. 40 years. God held them like a baby in the womb. He protected them. He nourished them. He gave them what they needed. But the time had come to quit walking by sight and to start to walk by faith. It's easy to believe there's a God when you can look at a pillar of fire right there over the tabernacle where it always is. Yep, God's there. He's home. Light's on. But when I can't see that pillar anymore, is God still there?
You better go by faith.
You got to believe God's still there. You know, everything we've done, my whole life, here I am a young man, I'm coming into the army, we're going to go possess this land. Every day of my life, I've seen that pillar of fire and pillar of cloud. And mama has gone and they picked up manna every morning, 6 days a week, twice as much on the sixth day. So my whole life's founded on. But now, no more manna. Now, no more pillars. Do I still believe there's a God? Do I still believe He's providing for me? I've got to do my part now. I've got to go and I've got to do. And we are entering into the land of blessing. So now the blessing is to be taken from the land. So, if you want to possess it, you want to reap some grain, you better go possess a field. You know, you want some olive oil, you better go possess an olive grove. Okay? They had to do it themselves. And this is a maturity thing. Go ahead. Go ahead.
That was the end of the growth process, just compared to the way we do our children. You know, the food's there automatically, and they don't have to worry about where it's coming from or who's paying for it or anything. Mm-hmm. And then there comes a time when that stops.
Yeah. You've got to fend for yourself.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the provider of blessings is still there and is accessible, but there becomes a time when maturity demands that you take control of your own actions and what have you. It's almost like, you know, this baby that was here a little while ago obviously cannot survive on its own. It's got to be nurtured. It's got to be fed. It's got to be changed. It's got to be taught how to survive. Hopefully by the time that child's a teenager, it can go make itself a hot dog, put on its own clothes, and whatever else is necessary to function in this world.
Yeah, mommy, don't hang to it too long. That's the next problem.
That's another teaching. Entirely.
But
you know, there comes a time even in nature when the eagle takes the fluff out of the nest and exposes the thorns and says, baby, it's time to fly.
Yep.
Yes, Zita. With the goal of them maturing until they feed themselves. God placed apostles and prophets, evangelists and pastors and teachers in the church. For what reason? To equip the saints for the work of the gospel. Okay? And we, in pews, are supposed to continue that process. Because you know what? Pastor Joel and myself, we can't be there 24/7 for every one of you to guide you and mentor you. Sometimes it would be completely inappropriate for us to do so. But if people in the pews have been equipped to do the work of the gospel, then there's going to be a Zeta that can go talk to somebody. There's going to be a Ray that can go talk to somebody. You know, we're going to have these people who have been equipped to help the little ones along the way. Little ones, spiritually speaking. We need to bring them to maturity. Trying to decide where I want to go in this last 15 minutes here. Okay. So we basically need to possess our promises the same way Israel was going to possess this promised land. There are some principles here. This whole thing started with Moses. I went back into the end of Deuteronomy where Moses taught the people their history and what the Torah said about how they were to live, right? So you've got to know the promises God has made to his children. If you're going to possess God's promises, you first must know what they are. Where do we find them?
In the book.
We find them in the Bible. What are we entitled to as God's children? What has God promised to do for us? What has God promised to help us do? You know, we need to know them before we can possess them. Israel, their history was rehearsed to them by Moses. They were exposed to it. They were told what God had promised them. In this case, you'll possess every place you put your foot. Then we got to decide to walk in the promises. The promise made to these children of Israel was this: you'll possess every place you put your foot. If you sit down and cross your feet in your lap, that's all you're going to possess is your lap. It required a decision to follow God and believe God, along with the effort to do so.
Faith. Hmm? It's faith.
Which is faith. Yeah, that is faith in action. I believe, I heard God, believe God, I'm going to do what God says I can do. Right? Not that we do it in our own strength or that we do it in our own understanding, but you know, in everything God does, he has a part, we have a part. He says, I will provide for you the means to accomplish this task. Okay? His part is to give you the orders and provide the means. Your part is to go attempt it. You got to walk it out. So these folks had to walk it out. Early in the book of Joshua, we kept hearing a refrain. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and very courageous. So in the midst of walking in these promises, we need to be strong and courageous, which means, as we've learned, you need to keep encouraging yourself. How do you keep encouraging yourself? You rehearse God's promises. See them with your eyes, speak them with your mouth, hear them with your ears. Build yourself up in that process.
And when people that don't understand what you're doing tells you how crazy you are, you gotta know it.
You gotta show them you ain't crazy.
You just gotta keep doing it.
What do you mean you're gonna go out and pour oil on a tractor at 3 o'clock in the morning? You know.
It'll run.
Yeah. You lay hands on that thing.
That's your title deed. That's your title deed?
That's your title deed, is acting in that faith. Those of you that were here for prayer meeting, we did something a little unusual this evening. Not going to tell you what it was, but somebody that walked in and looked in the back door said, them people's crazy.
Well, that's where the witness comes in. When
somebody
you're out laying
hands
on something at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you nosy neighbor's watching you, the one that's telling everybody how crazy you are, then the next day they see that it worked. It's kind of like, maybe I'll check out what they're doing.
Yeah. Maybe we'll wear a chicken with that fellow. He's crazy.
I don't know what they got, but I want some of that.
Yeah. Well, you've been drinking. I like some of that.
Now, Joel's place. Now, the corollary or the opposite of that is also true. We said be strong and courageous, right? Don't be terrified or discouraged, for God is with you. You know, the enemy likes to bring in fear. Fear is misplaced faith. Fear is faith in failure. Fear is faith in defeat. Fear is trusting your own strength and your own wisdom instead of God's.
Fear will kill faith.
Fear kills faith. Absolutely. If you let it have a foothold, it will eat you alive from the inside.
That's vice versa too. Faith kills fear.
Absolutely. The two are diametrically opposite each other. And whichever one you choose to walk in has the power to defeat the other one.
Yeah.
You know, when we walk in the realm of what if I fail? It's never worked for me before. What if this? When we walk in that realm, we will never possess the promises of God.
And one thing we need to realize too is that when we walk in faith, we're inviting angels over into our situation to help. And when we walk in fear, we're inviting the demons over into our situation to make it even worse.
The parallel worlds of the natural realm and the spiritual realm is one of the places that our liberal, anti-church, worldly friends laugh at us about. If they only knew who was pulling the chain that was leading them around, maybe they would see it differently.
They have been about the scripture this week.
Oh, they always do.
The lamp and the movie stars and stuff have actually been on the news spouting out scripture
that they do not understand.
They don't even know what they're saying.
Nor do they have the authority to speak. I'm not going to get into the current state of affairs that is tormenting folks, but you notice how the left has jumped on the bandwagon and tried to take our weapons and throw them at certain people, entities, organizations. And, ironically, maybe they're like these people, the Amorite kings and the Canaanite kings that heard a report of what God did and are trying to maybe appropriate some of his power to try to defeat God's people. It's kind of like when they tried to hire Balaam to curse Israel, We just got to hold on to our own thing. We can't be discouraged. Consecrate or sanctify yourself. For us, that means to walk in a state of repentance. We need to dedicate ourselves to the things of God. Then we got to follow God's instructions. Remember how he told them specifically how to line up to cross that river? For specifically what to do? We got to do it his way. And when we get into the next chapter, we're going to find out that God issues some extremely strange military instructions. But they did what he said,
and it worked.
And the neighbors probably thought he was crazy.
And the neighbors thought, I guarantee you there were people on the walls of Jericho laughing at them when they were walking around the city.
It's just like the book of instructions. Follow the instructions. They work.
We're afraid of them. They're crazy. They won't even yell back at us when we hurl insults at them. Be encouraged and be encouragers. See, that's that faith building process again. We encourage ourselves with the word. We remind each other what God says. We remind ourselves what God says. You know, the secular psychologists talked about self-talk for a long time. It's not new to them. You encourage yourself with the word. You speak the word to yourself. You say what God says about you and quit saying what the world says about you. You bless your children and don't tell them they're going to turn out just like their sorry dad.
Yeah. Their mom
or whatever.
Or uncle or whatever.
Remember what God has done. Remember that pile of rocks? Hey, it's hard to deny that God brought us across the river on dry ground when there's a pile of rocks here that came out of the middle of the river. We got piles of rocks in our lives that came out of the middle of the river. Every so often we need to go look at them and say, you know what? God came through there. He came through there. He came through over here on this one. If he did those three, I reckon I can trust him on this one. Bury the past. There's another episode that's recounted here that says, in addition to those 12 rocks they took out of the middle of the river and piled up on the Promised Land side, they took 12 rocks.
Promised Land back out from the middle of the river.
From the other side of the river and put them in the middle of the river and buried them.
From the side they came from.
Side they came from. We're going to bury where we were and remember where we are and how we got there. See? There's a lot. Go ahead, Ray.
That is probably one of the hardest things to do is to bury the past.
You know every failure that you've had.
Yep.
You know everything that you wanted to do different.
And the devil will remind you
daily. Remind you every day.
Sometimes he doesn't have to because you'll remind yourself.
Yeah. I think we give the devil a lot of credit that he don't deserve.
Absolutely. Zeta?
There's a scripture in Exodus where the children of Israel just crossed over the Red Sea. It says that Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord which we will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you've seen today, you'll see again no more forever." So whenever that ends,
God buried Egypt, or at least the army of Egypt. He stuck their chariots in the mud. And amazing, the people of Israel crossed over on dry ground, but the chariots got their wheels stuck in the mud. How did that happen?
I think a little bit of water might flow.
Something must have seeped in there just
all
a little bit.
Like across ours like a duck on dry land, hit like the mud hole.
Circumcise your heart. Therefore, the corruption stuff doesn't have place anymore.
Yeah,
if the heart's circumcised, you're not harboring those fleshly things, and you're exposing a sensitivity to the things of the Spirit.
Jesus said, "There comes a prince of this world, but he has no place."
No place. No room at the end. Celebrate in the community of faith. They celebrated the Passover. They remembered God's deliverance, okay? And then, and only then, they were able to enter in to the blessing. This is a pattern for us, okay? We need to do that. And next week, we'll talk about the captain of the host and the, quote, battle, end quote, of Jericho. Okay? Anybody have anything to share? Be blessed. We'll see y'all Sunday.